The talk you're about to listen to is a presentation of Penn State Crew. To find out more about Penn State Crew, or to find more talks, music, and videos, check out PennStateCrew.org.
Well, open your Bibles, if you have one, to Exodus chapter 20, and we'll get started here. This year, we've been studying the Ten Commandments, and we've seen that it's not just a record of how we're supposed to live, but more than that, it's really a record of how Jesus lived for us. The Ten Commandments, which we often fail to obey, were perfectly obeyed by Jesus. He, on our behalf, he lived a perfect life of holiness and righteousness, and then he offers us credit for it. It's absolutely incredible. He turns to us after living this perfect life and says, I'll give you credit, so that every time my Father looks at you, he'll essentially see me. He'll see the perfect life that I lived. And tonight we're going to look at the Eighth Commandment, which I'll warn you as we get started here, as I've studied this, the Eighth Commandment, and as I've listened to others who I respect talk about it, and as I've read my Bible with fresh eyes, this really just this past week, this one is not nearly as simple as it looks, and there's a lot more going on here than I thought. What we're going to be talking about tonight is not what I thought we'd be talking about when I kind of imagined where we're going. So let's take a look at this tonight, and if you would, please stand with me in honor of the Word of God as we read it together. We're going to look at Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 and 2 and 15. All right? It says this. And God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall not steal. All right, have a seat. All right, so it says, you shall not steal. Now, this may sound like kind of a stupid question, but just humor me on this. What does that mean? What does it mean to not steal? Give me that in your own words. Don't take something that's not yours. Very good, James. Yeah, give me a couple other. What is it? Don't eat. Has this happened recently? It's a sore spot. Okay, don't eat Rebecca's food. Yeah. Don't take stuff that's not yours. Don't eat your roommate's food. That's probably exactly what God had in mind, that one. And yeah, what else? What does that mean? Do not steal. Do not steal. Or let me frame it this way. What does it look like when we fail to keep this? What does stealing look like? Give me an example, other than eating your roommate's food, of stealing taking place. Yeah, Jeremiah. Yeah, right? The whole Napster era, that's a bad scene. So all the stuff you've got that you didn't pay for, you should go delete it. You really should. Okay, what else? What else does it look like when you steal? What is that? What does it mean to steal? Have you ever done that, Christine? Wow. So that might have been lost and found technically. So that might not be as bad. I found this little mirror once when I was in a grocery store, and I took it home because it was cool. Because like mirrors, anything metal when you're a little boy is cool, a mirror. And I remember thinking, did I steal that? It really bothered me for a long time. Not so much anymore, but when I was a little kid, I did. Okay, pretty much though, we could go on with all these little inane examples. And your thoughts are pretty much going to match my own. I mean, stealing, it's pretty obvious. It's not that difficult of a question. Stealing is when you take something that's not yours. But I want to suggest to you that there's a whole lot more going on to it than just that. You and I, we share a common cultural heritage. And because of that, we're going to view things largely through the same lenses. We all have a culture, and our culture really determines how we view stuff. And a culture can be like a pair of sunglasses, and it colors what we see. Sometimes that coloring helps. Like if you have a pair of sunglasses of the right hue, then it helps you to ski because you can see the moguls better in the snow, right? Sometimes it helps. But sometimes the coloring of our lenses, the culture that we have, can obscure our view of things. And I want to, my challenge tonight is going to be to try to lift you up out of the sea that you've swam in your entire life and help you determine if maybe the culture that you've always been a part of has made it harder, has obscured in some way something that's very near to God's heart. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about two events, kind of parallel events, one from our culture, from an American culture, and then one from the culture to which the Ten Commandments were originally given. And I'm hoping to kind of let that parallel experience kind of be a lens to help you see some stuff that you may not have ever really thought about. And to be honest, that I had not really thought about a great deal of before this week, before I started to study this. So, first one, we're going to do the American one, okay? And I wonder if there's any history buffs, American history people, know your stuff out here? Nobody? Okay, this is not going to work. Okay, great. Anybody have a clue at all? What happened in the United States on April 22nd, 1889? Then it happened again, September 16th, 1893. Anybody have any idea? It's kind of a big deal. Do you know? You don't know. Okay. Yeah, beers. Go ahead. No, those would have been actually a good bit earlier. 1889, 1893 in Oklahoma. Does that help? This is a quintessential American event. Oklahoma, late 1800s. What are we getting? No, we kind of just did that all the time. That was just a perpetual state of reality. Yeah, that's hard to pinpoint. Yeah. Something 1889, 18... That was a bad thing. Sorry about that. I didn't do it. I'm from New England, New Hampshire. We didn't steal land from anybody. Anybody? What's that? No, that would have been earlier because Jefferson did that, so that would have been a good bit earlier. Last guess, and then I'll tell you the answer. Dust. The Dust Bowl, Dust Storm, that was later. That was the 1900s. But that's good. Yeah, but that's Oklahoma. That's right. Here's what it was. It was the great, those were the dates of the two great land rushes. Were you thinking that? You should have said it. I would have believed you. Okay, yeah. Land rushes. You know what I'm talking about when I say land rushes? The deal was the American government had just tons of land, just literally millions of acres of land. Yeah, it looked like this, right? Millions of acres of land, and they wanted it settled. Okay? So what they did is they divided it all up into plots of about 160 acres. A parcel of land was 160 acres, and they basically gave it away. If you guys saw, anybody see the film Far and Away? Right? Remember this now as it's coming back? That's what you saw depicted there was one of these great land rushes where they gave all the land away. So what they did is they divided up the U.S. Homestead Act. They divided the land up into 160-acre chunks, and they'd give it to anybody for nothing. I mean, $0, 160 acres of land that they would give away. And the deal was pretty much whoever got there first got the land. And so they were all, there were kind of rules about it. They'd all line up. This is, they're all, you can imagine all these horses and wagons and trains and bicycles, people on foot, all kind of lining up, wait, for real. This is true. And when the gun goes off, the people take off and they go to get the land. On the day of the biggest land rush, they gave away 42,000 parcels of land, 160 acres a shot. Okay, it's about 6.5 million acres of land for nothing, free land, okay? It's like, this is the essence of the American dream. And so, when they give away the land, everybody kind of lines up and gets ready to go and to grab it. If you think about it, if you know that they're giving away 42,000 acres of land, I mean, 42,000 parcels of 160 acres a shot, a lot of people wanted in on that. And so, on the biggest land rush, the one that took place in 1893, there were 100,000 people that showed up and lined up to go get their piece of land. You do the math real quick, 100,000 people, 42,000 parcels. Not everybody's going to get it. So when that gun goes off and everybody just cruises, like, you know, they just go. They just run to get the land. Whoever gets there first, it's theirs. Unless somebody shoots them and then takes it from them. And that happened. And people got trampled to death by the horses. And people cheated. And there were disputes. And there were fights. But when it was all said and done, if you could get the land, if you could get there first and settle it and protect it, it was yours. Okay? Yeah, that is quintessential America right there. Okay, that is American, you know the phrase rugged individualism? That's who we are. Okay, American rugged individualism. Right there at its height, you get the land and it's yours. And it was a sweet thing. Every man for himself, but if you get it, protect it, it's yours. Okay, that whole thing is just a classic picture of who we are as a nation, as a culture. We love ownership. We're all about personal property rights. You get there, you work hard, you get it, keep it because it's yours, all right? That's really the essence of the American dream. And if that's who you are, if that's where you come from, then do not steal is real simple. All that do not steal means is I keep my stuff, you keep your stuff, and it's kind of hands off, all right? That's pretty much all the answers that we gave is that's what it means to not steal. Don't take my stuff, and I won't take yours. We play fair and square. I work hard. I keep what I gain. And I don't mess with you, and I'm good, right? I haven't stolen a thing. That's just kind of the way we think. But what's interesting, you guys, is that the Ten Commandments was given right before another land rush. But in that land rush, the rules of engagement were completely different, okay? The Ten Commandments are given right between two great events. It is between the slavery of Israel in Egypt and their getting of the land, okay? They've been enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. They had no land. They had nothing. And God promised them this rich and beautiful and fertile land. And the Ten Commandments come kind of on the way out of slavery and into the land. They're going to go get it, okay? But in this one, this other land rush, the one that took place for Israel, it's completely different. It looked absolutely nothing like the great American land rushes because there was plenty of land for everybody. And there were rules established to make sure that absolutely everybody's needs were met. It wasn't a fight to get to the land. It wasn't a dog-eat-dog thing. And the whole thing, it's bizarre. If you guys read, sometimes if you read through the Old Testament, there's a lot of stuff in there. You think, this doesn't, I don't know, how does that work? That's weird. That is very different. And it is. And I want to show you some of the stuff that's very different, but I want to help you see the reason that it was so different. Okay, what they were trying to, what God was trying to value is very different from a lot of the stuff that you and I have always valued really every day of our lives. So let me try to show you some of this. When they got the land, the way it works is every tribe got a chunk. There are 12, basically 12 tribes. It's kind of funny math, but basically 12 groups of people, and every tribe kind of was allotted a chunk of land based on how big they were, and then within that, the land was further divided into the families, into the clans. And it was set up so that that land would remain in your family basically forever. Every 50 years, if for some reason things had gotten hard and you had to sell your land and whatever had come up on you and you had to kind of lose your land, every 50 years, it just got reset back to the original ownership. It was designed so that everybody's needs would be met and that they'd be met indefinitely. Even if you screwed up, you get your land back. It's just really weird. Not only that, did you know that according to the laws that God gave Moses in the Ten Commandments and then in following the Ten Commandments, every 7 years, if anybody was in debt, the debts were just wiped out. They're clean. They're gone. Okay, that's weird. Okay, can you imagine like every 7 years of credit cards, just your balance gets cleared off, your mortgage is canceled, everything is gone every 7 years. Okay, that's just really weird, but that's exactly what happened. And so you know what? I'm making it up. Take a look. Deuteronomy 15. Grab this for us, Bowman. Here's Deuteronomy 15. It says, at the end of every 7 years, you must cancel debts. And this is how it is to be done. Every creditor shall cancel the loan that he's made to his fellow Israelite. He shall not require payment from his fellow Israelite or brother, because the Lord's time for canceling debts has been proclaimed. If there's a poor man among your brothers, or in any of the towns of the land that the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward your poor brother. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend him whatever he needs. But be careful not to harbor this wicked thought. The seventh year, the year of canceling debts, is near, so that you do not show ill will toward your needy brother and give him nothing. He may then appeal to the Lord against you, and you will be found guilty of sin. Give generously to him, and do so without a grudging heart. And then because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed toward your brothers and toward the poor and needy in your land. That's weird, isn't it? That is very different from the life that we've lived forever. Because in our culture, the lending industry exists to make a profit. It's a business. And so we'll give people money right now in the short term when they need it, with the understanding that they'll pay us back over the long term, but pays back a little bit more, sometimes a lot more, than they lend in the first place. And so it's a profit-making venture. But in Israel, that wasn't the case. There were no mortgage companies. It wasn't designed to be a profitable business. It was a mercy. You lend to people when they have need because they're in some kind of a dire situation. And what God says here in this passage is, I hate people being enslaved to debt. I don't want anybody to be oppressed because they didn't have enough money. And so here's what I want you to do. After every 7 years, we're just going to clear the slate. I want you to cancel all those debts. And listen, if you do that, I will pay you back myself. I'll make sure that your land will be so rich and prosperous that all your needs will be met. Just don't oppress the poor. That's real different, guys. In our culture, it's a totally different setup. Did you catch this line here? It says, if you don't do this, you're going to be guilty of sin. What sin would you be guilty of, do you think? Which of the Ten Commandments would this trace back to? Imagine it's year six. You know the cancellation year is just like, you know, 11, 12 months out. And somebody comes to you because they're in some situation they have need and they need your help. But you know full well that there's no way they're going to pay you back. It's going to be get out of jail free time. And so you decide to hold off and to not lend them the money. Which commandment are you violating? It's this one, guys. It's the eighth. According to God, in that situation, what you're doing is you are stealing from that poor person. And that's a definition unlike any of the things that we just kind of bantered through at the beginning of this time. You're stealing. Let me give you some other examples what it means not to steal in this context. These are out of Exodus 23. It says, if you come across your enemy's ox or donkey wandering off, your enemies, by the way, be sure to take it back to him. If you see the donkey of someone who hates you, fallen down under its load. Do not leave it there, but be sure that you help him with it. Now, that doesn't sound like stealing to us, but according to the Bible, it is. Anytime we fail to protect someone's economic interests, even if it's our enemy, that's stealing. Further on, it says in verse 6, do not deny justice to the poor people in their lawsuits. Do not oppress an alien. You yourselves know how it feels to be aliens because you were aliens in Egypt. And check this out. In verse 10, it says this. For 6 years, you are to sow your fields and harvest the crops. But during the seventh year, let the land lie unplowed and unused. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. Do the same with your vineyards and your olive grove. Y'all see what God is advocating for here is a radically different perspective on wealth and ownership than we've ever had. He says, it's your land. It is your land. He gave it to you, but I gave it to you with the understanding that its produce would not just provide for you, but for the poor. And if you don't, if you fail to do that, you're not just failing to be generous, but you're stealing. You're taking the provision that God intends for them to be able to enjoy. You see that? Makes sense? Different. Guys, when this is your vantage point and you double click on do not steal, the thing just explodes and you see that to steal is to do anything, whether it's an act of commission or an act of omission, that takes people the provision that God takes from people the provision that God wants them to have. I want you to see that what's in view here in the eighth commandment is not just stealing as you might think of it, but is a total picture of social justice. The obligation of the commandment not to steal is the obligation to see justice done so that everybody gets what they need, so that everybody's needs are met. It's not just an affirmation of the value of people's stuff. It's an affirmation of the value of people. I want you to listen. This is John Lynn. He's a pastor in New York. This is what he says about this. He says, the eighth commandment is not just a corrective for coveting, and it's not there primarily to address selfishness or shoplifting or carjacking or kleptomania. The eighth commandment is a matter of social justice. It's there to prevent economic oppression. And if the eighth commandment reminds us not to forcefully deprive people of their resources, economic material, and so on, the flip side is that the eighth commandment reminds us that our resources are specifically intended to be used to help those that are deprived. It's not just about taking resources from another who's in need. It's also about whether you have given resources to someone who is in need. If you've amassed resources just for yourself, just for personal enrichment, just for your own enjoyment, it is in fact the same thing as taking resources from another for your enrichment. I don't know, you guys, how that strikes you, but as I've been thinking about this for the last week, it has begun to just absolutely unravel the way that I think about my stuff. What if people, what if the poor have a right to my stuff? And I know to your and mine American ears, I know that sounds pretty absurd. We have a sense of rights that's based on ownership. But what I want you to think about here tonight is what if there's a higher law, a higher system than ownership? What if, for instance, God doesn't think it's right for the kids in Haiti to be eating mud cookies? Anybody see the story in the paper about 2 weeks ago? You see this? 2 weeks ago, Center Daily Times, there's a story about Haitian kids eating mud cookies. You got this, Bowman? Okay, let me read you. This is out of the Center Daily Times. They picked it up from the AP. It says this. In places like Cité Soleil, the Oceanside slum, which with Charlene shares a two-room house with her baby, five siblings, and two unemployed parents, cookies made of dirt, salt, and vegetable shortening have become a regular meal. When my mother does not cook anything, I have to eat them three times a day, Charlene said. Her baby, named Woodson, lay still across her lap, looking even thinner than the slim 6-pound, 3 ounces he weighed at birth. Although she likes their buttery, salty taste, Charlene said that the cookies also give her stomach pains. When I nurse, the baby sometimes seems colicky too, she said. Merchants truck the dirt from the central town of Hinche to the market, a maze of tables of vegetables and meat swarming with flies. Women buy the dirt, then process it into mud cookies in a nearby shanty town. Carrying buckets of dirt and water up ladders to the roof of the former prison, they strain out rocks and clumps on a sheet and stir in shortening and salt. Then they pat the mixture into mud cookies and leave them to dry under the scorching sun. The finished cookies are carried in buckets to markets or sold on the streets. A reporter sampling a cookie found that it had a smooth consistency and sucked all the moisture out of the mouth as soon as it touched the tongue. For hours, an unpleasant taste of dirt lingered. Guys, that should not be. That's wrong. What if there's a higher law going on here than just personal property rights? What if God has given to me so that I can give to others? What if the lens through which God views the world isn't the one that champions individualism, but is the one that champions individuals? Would that mean that when I'm amassing wealth and just kind of storing it up for myself and not giving it away, that I'm in effect stealing? Am I withholding from people the things that God says I'm supposed to give to them? If so, then this commandment speaks to a much higher standard, and I'm not obeying it nearly as well as I thought I was. Check this out. The very day that I was pondering this, you know, we're together, many of us are reading through the New Testament, and the day that I was thinking through this, my little card told me to read Ephesians 4, and so I did. And so listen, here's what it says. This is Ephesians 4:28. It says, "He who has been stealing must steal no longer." Right? Eighth commandment. Very timely. It says, "He who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with his own hands." Now, do you remember the next phrase from when you read it? I remember this. "He who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with those who are in need." That just totally struck me. If I had been writing that, I would have said, "He who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with his hands, so that he can pay his own rent and buy his own food," right? That's why you step, get a job, take care of yourself. But that's not what it says. According to Paul, what God has in mind here in place of robbery isn't keeping your hands to yourself. It's giving your stuff away. That's why you get a job. Now, be honest, how many of you chose a college and have decided on a career and hope to get a job so that you can earn money and give it away? Not many of us, right? That's not kind of the way we tend to think about it at all. But could it be, you guys, that as long as you and I are not thinking in those terms, that we really are, in effect, stealing? Got me thinking. So I started looking up all the passages I could think up in the New Testament that talk about wealth. Let me just kind of run through just a couple with you. This is 1 Tim 6. It says, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant or to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment." I like that part. And here's the next verse. "Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share." 2 Corinthians, same idea. 2 Corinthians 9 says, "Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will also supply and increase your store of seed and will enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. You will be made rich in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion, and through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God." And that principle is applied also in 2 Corinthians, verse chapter 8, says, "Our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn their plenty will supply what you need. And then there will be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little." Because I've read these passages a million times, but I've always missed it. It never really struck me that we don't just give away our wealth because people need it. We get our wealth because people need it. That was the point in the first place. Giving it away, you guys, is not an optional afterthought. It was the point in the very beginning. So what's it mean? I think for me, and I suspect for many of us, it means that we really need a radical reorientation to our view of wealth and ownership. And by the way, let me just throw this out there. In case you think I'm advocating communism, I'm not. That is always a disaster, okay? State-run Marxism ruins everything. It always produces poverty, okay? Everybody's equal, but they're equally miserable, and it's just a wreck. Nobody's needs are met. Free market capitalism does produce wealth, and it's vastly superior to communism. But the question for us, the question for the individuals in these societies like ours, and especially for Christians, is what do you do with the wealth once this incredible system has produced it. Some of you are going to earn a lot of money. Every one of us is going to earn a lot of money by world standards. I want you to wonder, why is that? To what end did God give you a keen mind and a great education and enable you to live in a country with such a powerful infrastructure and just absolutely incredible wealth-producing capacity? Was it so you could amass wealth and live a life at ease? Or was it so you could give it away? Care for the poor, support missionaries, fund orphanages, and redeem slaves, and advance his kingdom, and love people. Well, I suspect if that's as challenging to you as it is to me, we should talk just for a moment about what could possibly motivate us to have that kind of view of life and of wealth. What could enter into our lives and to make us kind of open up our fists and live a life of generosity, kind of relinquishing our stuff? I'll tell you what's not going to work is guilt. If you leave here feeling guilty that the kids in Haiti are eating mud cookies, I'm pretty sure that's going to dissipate by the weekend. That's not going to change their lives. It's not going to change yours. Guilt is a worthless motivator. But maybe this. I began tonight by suggesting that the Ten Commandments is a record of the life that Jesus lived on our behalf. I want you to think about everything we've been talking about through the lens of his life. Because isn't this exactly what he did? Think about yourself. Do you realize that you were poor and oppressed? You didn't have the resources you needed. You had no chance to get them. What the poor people of the world are materially, you and I were spiritually, desperate and hopeless. And into that stepped the Son of God. He gave you a gift that you didn't earn, had no way to obtain, and he did it at dear cost to himself. Paul puts it like this. He says, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you, through his poverty, might become rich." He was wealthy in every possible regard, attended by angels, worshipped in glory, in intimacy with the Father, ruling the universe, and he left it all. And he emptied himself, became a man, became a slave, and submitted to death by crucifixion. He gave away everything, including his own righteousness, so that he could absorb the wrath of God against thieves like us. He became poor so that we could become rich. If you haven't yet taken up that wealth of the purity and right standing with God that he offers, I hope that maybe tonight you will. He bought it for you with his own blood, and he offers it as a free gift. And if you have done it, I hope that this just might put a crack in your system here. You might start to see that your material wealth has been given to you so that you can give to others. Y'all, there's nothing wrong with wealth. And the Bible affirms that the worker deserves his wages. But you and I are very likely to have much, much more than we need. And the question is, what do we do with our wealth? And why did God give it to us in the first place? Jesus said that the thief comes to steal and destroy, but I came to give life and to give it abundantly. So I'd love you to leave tonight wondering, who do you want to be like? Will you steal? Will you hoard your wealth and spend it all on yourself? Or will you give your life away in response to the one who gave his life for you? Pray for you and myself that we'd obey this commandment. Dear Jesus, you are so great, and you perfectly obeyed this thing. You are no thief, but you give, and you give with generosity that we can't even approach. Lord, I pray for these students for whom this is probably as radical to them as it has been to me this week. And Lord, I don't know on my own. I'm not even sure what this means for me to apply. I'm not sure. What does this mean for Kelly and I? What do we need to look at, and what decisions do we need to change? And I pray for myself and for these ones that you'd help us to figure out what does it mean to live a life of radical generosity and love, that we would be more like Jesus and less like the thieves. And we thank you that you love us and that you forgive us, that Jesus, we're not talking about what we need to do to earn your favor here, because because we already have it. But you delighted in us, and you chose to die for us. I pray you'd help us, empowered by your love, to reflect that to others. That we would give generously, because you are so sweet and so good and so generous to us. We love you, Jesus. Thanks for loving us. Amen.
The talk you have just listened to is a presentation of Penn State Crew. Crew is a community where the gospel captures hearts, transforms lives, and launches men and women into a lifelong adventure with Jesus Christ. To find out more about Penn State Crew, or to find more talks, music, and videos, check out PennStateCrew.org. That's PennStateCRU.org. This talk is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. You are free to copy and distribute this talk to others as long as you do not do it for commercial purposes or alter, transform, or build upon this talk in any way.